since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called.
And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide
at 1041kqth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Welcome to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Great show today. You know, we very often like to feature veterans who found success in civilian careers. Today we're going to do that. On April 21st, a new film named Sandcastle will be debuting on Netflix. It's set in Iraq during the Second Gulf War. Sandcastle tells the story of an inexperienced Army private who, along with his fellow soldiers, is ordered to repair a water pumping station on the outskirts of Bakuba, a pumping station destroyed by U.S. bombs. What follows is a drama that highlights the conflicts among parties on both sides of the war. That makes something as straightforward as repairing a pumping station not quite so simple as you'll find when you watch the film. The film is directed by Fernando Combra, who you might recognize if you watch the hit Netflix series Narcos. Joining American Warrior today, we're very, very proud and pleased to have the screenwriter of Sandcastle, himself an Army veteran of the Iraq War, Chris Rossner. Chris, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thanks, Ben. I'm very happy and proud to be here.
Well, you must be. I mean, you got to be kind of jazzed, Chris. Your first film debuting on Netflix in what, 6 days?
That's right. I think it's. I think we're under a week now. It's pretty wild. The last couple of days, and I'm sure the next couple of days, will be a bit of a blur, but a blur of happiness nonetheless.
Well, and congratulations to you, and as our listeners will hear, this kind of success, particularly in that industry, does not come easy, if at all, for many young people. Now, Chris,
that's right.
I'm sorry?
That's right. I was laughing because I had a flash of like the last decade of how hard it was, but yes.
We'll get to that too, but your story, it's interesting to me, your story is one we've heard before on American Warrior Radio. You joined the Army to help pay for college film school, to be precise, but there was another motivation there that I find really interesting on your backstory. It has to do with your father. You said you were bullied into the military by the ghost of someone you didn't even know. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, my mom and my dad met at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. That's where I was conceived, my mom and dad sort of split ways. He was an officer, and he was a West Point guy and very much a career military gentleman. And my mom, you know, after her 4 years of service, she was sort of finished. And there was no hard feelings between the two of them. They just kind of went their separate ways. And he continued on and had a hell of a career in the Army. But my mom raising me as a single mother never spoke ill of him. In fact, just the opposite. You know, she told me about West Point and, you know, he's a special forces guy. And, you know, I kind of had my whole life just built this man up in my mind. And, you know, I'd never met him. And then when I got to Iraq, when I was deployed, I sent my first email to him. I was about 19 years old and he replied right away. And he told me to be safe. And he had some buddies over there, a colonel he went to West Point with. We kind of dispatched the next day to come sit with me and talk to me and make sure I was okay. And then I would eventually meet my dad when I got back. I was about 27 at the time, the first time I met him. And I didn't realize it when I had sent him that email originally, but I don't think it was an accident that the first time I reached out to him was when I was in Iraq. I think I was kind of trying to earn the right to have a conversation with this man that I built up in my mind. You know, again, when you're a teenager, you don't realize the depths of some of the decisions that you make. But I think for most young men, everything kind of comes back to your dad. And, you know, I was just kind of trying to impress him, probably.
Well, now, do you find now, Chris, that the bond between a father and son is usually a strong one? you had that gap in your relationship, but do you find that your combined joint, you know, your military service has helped bridge that to some extent now as you're going forward with your lives?
Absolutely. I think, you know, anybody who returns from war feels a kinship, of course, with the people they served with and the people that served in that particular war, but you also feel a kinship to anybody who's ever worn the uniform and deployed. So, you know, I came back and there was some, you know, like most people, a bit of an adjustment period. And so when I reached out to my dad, we had that common ground to talk about. We, you know, I think the first conversation we had, you know, over a beer was, you know, about my time in the service and then his time in the service. And it really kind of took all of the potential awkwardness out of it. And, we've had a great relationship ever since. I mean, and it's hard to say that when you meet somebody at 27 that you're going to have this like father-son bond, but we did bond pretty quickly. And, you know, we stayed in touch ever since. So, you know, that's one of the positive things I think the war gave to me.
Now, Chris, just to clarify, you joined the Army to pay for tuition, to pay for film school, but that was prior to 9/11, right?
That's right. I usually tell folks, you know, I signed up July 11th, 2001, and if you do the math, you realize I have kind of the worst timing of anybody. But that was the initial impulse was to pay for college. But, you know, you sign up for a peacetime army, and then the one you end up serving in is much different.
So 9/11 happens, you're off to Iraq. How many missions, or how long were you there, and how many missions did you have in Iraq?
I was in Iraq over a year, and I'd say a year and a month. I used to have the exact amount of days memorized, but I've long forgotten. But I was there a year and change, and I ran about, you know, 200 and some odd missions in the Sunni Triangle.
In the Sunni Triangle?
That's right. Yeah, we had a...
Yikes.
It was the first couple months weren't so bad, you know, given that it was the start of the war, 2003, and then after about 4 months, the honeymoon period was kind of over. And when people see the film, I kind of made it a point to depict that rather swift change.
Now it's interesting to me, Chris. Your job was, you served in a civil affairs unit.
Yes, sir.
And having, you know, one of the cool things about doing radio is I have been able to see the film already, even though most folks haven't. What was your job supposed to be in civil affairs, and what did it end up being?
Right. So the job of civil affairs, in the strictest sense, is to, you know, it really is a hearts and minds mission. You liaise with the local populace. You try to understand any sort of collateral damage that has occurred in their country, whether you're responsible for it or not, and you are trying to help, you know, bridge that gap between your culture and theirs. You're trying to quite literally win the hearts and minds. So that's the job. And, you know, you go over there with that in mind, and it feels a bit ethereal, because in a way it is. And you kind of have to assess what your job in the day to day is going to be kind of after you get there. So a lot of my missions, you know, they varied quite a bit. Sometimes it was, you know, talking to a local Iraqi business owner whose business was destroyed, and we're trying to get money to repair that business. And then sometimes we had to transport millions of dollars in cash from one part of the country all the way down to the other part of the country, in which case I would quite literally be sitting on a giant footlocker of millions of dollars up in the turret. I would sort of pull my you know, pull my seat out and put in a giant footlocker of millions of dollars and just sit on top of that. And everything in between. I mean, it just varied so much. But the benefit was I got to see more of the country than just about anybody. And I got to travel around a lot and see a lot of, you know, a lot of the local people. And if we had success, I got to see it. And if we had failures, I got to see it. So I often say that I had, you know, pretty much the full spectrum of the war experience.
And, you know, that, it's interesting you say that, because now I can see definitely how you're, you know, Sandcastle is a fictional drama, but mm-hmm. was inspired by some of the things you saw clearly in your civil affairs, role there. Chris, when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the film and how you got from point A to point B. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bula Garcia. Great show here on American Warrior Radio. We're talking with Chris Rossner, He is the screenwriter for a film called Sandcastle, which debuts on Netflix coming up next week, April 21st. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. Your host here on Ben Gila Garcia here on American Warrior Radio. We're talking with Chris Rossner. Chris is an Army veteran, spent some time in Iraq, over 200 missions. One, he says, or several, he says, actually sitting on a big old locker full of cash as part of a civil affairs unit. He is the screenwriter for a film that's debuting on Netflix April 21st. It's called Sandcastle. Now, Chris, you know, we talk a little bit about your military service. The film itself is a fictional drama, but one of the things I wanted, before we get a little bit too much, you know, you and I have the advantage of you wrote it, I assume you've seen the finished product, right?
I have, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Just checking.
Fortunate enough to see it, yeah.
And one of the cool things about being in the radio is I've seen the finished product as well, but let's talk a little bit about the after the war, before the film. Now, one thing I find very impressive and I really like about you is that you're a Pat Tillman Scholar. Tell us
a little bit
about that and how that's impacted and helped with your career as you're moving forward in civilian life.
Well, the Pat Tillman Foundation has been an integral part of my success. And they, I mean, honestly, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't have been able to afford USC Film School, even after serving in the military. I mean, there still was this, you know, rather large financial gap between what the post 9/11 GI Bill provided, and the, you know, exorbitant cost of a private institution like USC. So I had applied for the scholarship, and was very fortunate and lucky and somehow slipped through the cracks and was able to, receive the scholarship and have that financial gap met. And as a result of that, made it to film school at USC, as we mentioned, and got the education that made writing this film possible, because the screenplay that I wrote was the very first screenplay I ever attempted. You know, I'd been writing a lot of poetry and prose, and I sort of saw myself like in the vein of a, you know, potential, you know, Tim O'Brien, you know, aspirant. But I knew that I kind of thought in film, I thought in pictures, and if I was a novelist, I would have wrote a book, but it just so happens that, you know, what I do is write movies. And if it wasn't for that particular scholarship, I never would have the skills necessary to translate what had been years and years of built up emotion and ideas and bits of dialogue and character descriptions. In order to get that to the page required, you know, a hell of an education, and it wouldn't have been possible if it wasn't for the Pat Tillman Foundation.
Well, and you picked a good one. My understanding is the USC Film School is one of the best in the country, if not in the world.
Yeah, they take film very seriously there. I mean, it's no joke. I showed up thinking I was quite the cinema hotshot, and then you realize that you are a little fish in a big pond, and you better start working right away. They don't mess around.
Now, it's interesting, after you returned from Iraq, you went to film school. You were still in the reserves at the time, correct? The Army Reserves?
That's right.
And I read an interview, Chris, where you mentioned some advice was given to your class by directing great Robert Zemeckis. Now, I don't know if that advice was meant to inspire you, or perhaps it was also designed to weed out the weaker ones as well as encouraging the strong ones. Share that advice with our listeners, if you would.
Yeah, I've never forgotten this piece of advice. I was about 22, 23. Robert Zemeckis, director of Forrest Gump, a host of other films, one of the greats, came to our class and he said, if you want to do this job, if you really want to, you can, it's possible, but it's going to cost you your 20s. Other people will buy homes, other people will be promoted and buy cars and have families, you will not. Your 20s will be dedicated to this. And I don't think he was far off. I mean, I wrote Sandcastle about 28, and it sold when I was about 29. So he was kind of dead on. And you know, as I said at the top of the program, I remember 10 very long, lean years. That's for sure.
Yeah, I kind of know what you're talking about. Now, what's interesting to me, Chris, is the story about how Sandcastles came to be in and of itself is almost a movie. You are guarding an abandoned palace somewhere in Iraq, probably classified. We don't want to mention that. During your downtime, you're watching the film Platoon, the classic film Platoon. Sun rises in the Rocky Desert, and that kicked it off, right? Was that really the beginning of Sandcastles?
It honestly was. I mean, it was a watershed moment, and it sounds cinematic because it actually was. I had never seen a movie made that was so deeply personal, like never mind the fact that it was about the Vietnam War, just a movie that was so intensely personal with this like rich, gorgeous voiceover, and it was so poetic, and the movie wasn't about like a singular mission. It was about, this is the experience of being a young man at war. And Charlie Sheen and all the other young actors at the time, they looked young. They looked like the guys that I was serving with. And that movie finished just as the sun was coming up, and there was the call to prayer, and like this light went off in my head. I said, every war has its film, right? I think Platoon was that for the Vietnam War. And I think it stands to reason that a film is going to exist that is going to be a cultural artifact of my war. And I don't know if I will be the person to make that film, but I sure as hell am going to try, because I don't know anybody else in this palace or anyone else I met in Iraq who is here because they want to afford film school. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I wanted to take a swing at it. And by the way, I know the movie hasn't come out yet, so of course I don't know if that's a lofty goal and if I hit the target or even close, and I kind of don't care, because even if the movie, inspires somebody that I served with to write their version of the war, and if that becomes the, you know, cultural artifact that rallies people around what it's like to be a young man at war, that's totally fine. I'm just happy to be a link in the chain.
Well, you know, Chris, you're an artist, and very often, you know, if you're a painter, you'd have to paint. If you, like you said, if you're a novelist, you'd have to write. You're a filmmaker,
right?
You've got to make a film. Now, I've talked, you know, over the years on American Warrior Radio, Chris, we've had lots of great military people with great stories, but a good story doesn't necessarily make a good film, I guess, if I can put it that way. Walk
sure.
us through your experience from the, you know, the reaction, I don't know who the very first person you showed your draft screenplay to, from their reaction to the day something called the blacklist came up. Now, I guess the blacklist is not necessarily a bad thing, but start us off, first person you show that screenplay to, if you recall.
Yeah, sure. I mean, absolutely. So I'd finished the screenplay, been writing it for a year. I was working another job in Hollywood, and I was writing the script from 7 in the morning until 8 in the morning. And then I'd work my job 8 to 8 p.m., and I'd go home, and I would go to sleep and start it all over again. I did that for a year, and I had a finished screenplay. And I did it just kind of to be cathartic, and also to kind of honor the amazing things that I saw my friends do. So I finish it, and I feel good about it, but I don't think that I have anything special at all. And I hand it to a coworker of mine. Her name was Sarah Smith, and I gave it to her on Friday, and I said, hey, can you do me a favor and take a look at this? And if you think it's good, like, let me know, and I'll keep going. So cut to Sunday night, that same weekend, I get a call from the big boss, this producer named Mark Gordon, who's an executive producer on the film. He's produced things like Saving Private Ryan, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
This guy knows what he's doing. So he calls me from London, and I pick up the phone, and he goes, what the hell is going on in L.A.? I didn't know what he was talking about. I thought I, like, messed up his travel or something. I thought I screwed up, you know, his schedule. I didn't book his hotel. But apparently, just over the course of that weekend, the script flew all around town and went through the agencies, and, you know, people were contacting Mark because they knew I was his assistant. They just sort of assumed that he knew about it, and he did not. Which, you know, he wasn't too pleased about, but, you know, he read the script and he said, I'm serious about this. I think you have something. You can clearly write, and this is going to be your occupation. But when I come back from London, we are going to spend 3 lunches every week going through this script, and getting it right. And if we don't finish what we set out to do over the course of lunch, you'll come to my house. My wife will make dinner, and we'll stay up till 1 or 2 in the morning. Whatever. And we did that for about 2.5-3 months. And then he said, you know, what are you still doing here? Leave. you shouldn't be working here anymore. And he kind of, you know, wrote me a nice little check and kicked me out. And that version of the script went out to the town at large, and then it made the 2012 blacklist, which is a collection of all the best as yet unproduced scripts of the time. And 2012, if I may, was a hell of a year. I had a lot of friends on that movie, a lot of friends on that script, that list. Eric Heiserer's script Arrival, which came out recently, was nominated, was on there. Taylor Sheridan's script Hell or High Water was on there. Damien Chazelle's Whiplash was on there. My script was on there. So I was just as pleased to see my name and script alongside those people as I was to be on it, period.
Well, there you go, Chris. We got to pay for this show here. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the film itself, the extent to which we can. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around, folks. Great interview with Chris Rossman.
Expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. You know, very often we like to talk to veterans who've been successful in the civilian world. We've got a doozy for you today. Chris Rossner wrote a screenplay. It was actually inspired one evening when he was guarding an Iraq palace, an abandoned Iraq palace. He wrote the screenplay, worked through it, and that movie, the result, Sandcastle, will debut April 21st on Netflix. Chris, you know, we talked a little bit about your, I don't say the challenges that you went through, but I read an article, an interview with you that someone asked you about, well, what was harder, you know, fighting the war in Iraq or your time in Hollywood, and I thought answer was very intriguing. Share your perspective on that with our listeners.
Yeah, I'm actually glad that you asked that question. It's one that, you know, caught me off guard the first time I heard it, but it's an answer I'm happy to repeat. I said that obviously serving in a wartime military is the toughest thing that you can do. It's emotionally taxing. It's emotionally taxing, clearly. But here's kind of where the difference is that in the military, and everyone who served knows this, you are serving alongside people who are focused intently on a common goal that is bigger than them, than themselves, right? And there's never any question about that. And you don't realize how rare that is when, you know, you're 19 years old like I was. But then you get to Hollywood or any other business really, but you know, let's take Hollywood, for example. And the task is gargantuan. Getting a movie made is gargantuan. It takes hundreds of people to make that happen. But what's emotionally taxing is that there are so many competing incentives for other people, right? Like there's people's careers at stake. There's money at stake. There's people who desperately want to impress their boss or, you know, don't want to be in trouble for something, so they're afraid to speak their mind or whatever. And that sort of like shift in priorities, even if it's by a few degrees over time, can become quite difficult to traverse. So, you know, making a film is emotionally taxing. Fighting a war is emotionally taxing. But at least in the Army, you're surrounded by people who know that what they're serving is more important than their individual agenda.
And I tell you, Chris, the reason I wanted to bring that up is that's such a powerful point that you make. When we talk about veterans who are struggling after they come out of the military and they're struggling to adjust, very often what I hear is one of the things they miss so much or that is missing from their lives so much is the sense of camaraderie, that sense of a common objective, a common mission, a common purpose. Have you so far found that anywhere else in Hollywood? I mean, did you kind of find that on the set of the film with the team that was put together to actually make this movie, or you haven't quite?
Oh, I mean, certainly. I mean, I think the for the most part, the folks that you know, said that they were willing to go to Amman, Jordan for 3 months and make a Iraq war film independently, that takes a special kind of person. And I feel like just the way the film was put together, kind of lucky for me, weeded out a lot of what could have been Hollywood nonsense, right? Like, there's not a real financial incentive in a big way. There's not a big financial incentive for anyone to go and spend so much time away from their families on the other side of the world, making a film that's pretty risky. I mean, you don't have a lot of time. You don't have a lot of money. So I think that helps. But having returned, I feel like what has helped me navigate the, you know, mess of Hollywood is I've built a really great infrastructure of other people. There's a lot of young, veteran screenwriters who are up and coming, and I try to like be, to the extent possible, the godfather of all of them, and I surround myself with them and I support them and they support me. So I feel like, you know, I've been building my own little platoon inside this larger machine the past couple of years, and that's been really effective.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate you sharing those insights with us, Chris. Let's talk a little bit about the film, the extent to which we can. Now, I mentioned earlier in the interview, this is a fictional story. It's not based on you, but it's inspired perhaps, or not perhaps, but by some of the things that you saw while serving in Iraq in a
right.
civil affairs unit. The story, long story short, is basically you've got a young soldier who's inexperienced, and his group is sent out to repair a water station at a remote location, a water pumping station that was blown up by our bombs, and kind of what proceeds from there. And it's interesting to me that, Chris, you've said there's plenty of action in the film, but you said this is not an action film.
Right. Yeah, I mean, not in the strictest sense. I think, you know, there are down-the-middle action films that are, you know, get off my plane or give me back my family or whatever else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not, or take that hill or kill that bad guy or whatever. And in that regard, I think it would do this movie a disservice to call it simply an action film. Like, there's plenty of action, but this is trying to put the audience in the boots of people who are about to spend a year at war, right? We worked very hard to delay the first, you know, bullet flying
mm-hmm.
as long as possible. And the reason for that, and this is what I've said to everybody kind of from the start, is, you know, I have an allegiance to the feeling of war, not the, you know, not like the journalistic reportage of war. Like, I'm not interested in the shaky camera. I'm not interested in every event that took place mirroring in a one-to-one ratio what I experienced. I care about imparting a feeling of war on the audience. And the way that I think to do that is to spend a lot of time making an audience fall in love with someone and then kill that person in front of them, which I know is a macabre thing to say, but war can be macabre sometimes, right? And
yeah.
for me, that's what I had an allegiance to. I had an allegiance to painting these characters with as much nuance as possible, making them funny as possible. And I know that, you know, given the trailer that's been released and the scene that's been released, at this point, I think the audience will be surprised at how funny the movie is. But that's for a reason. And it's because war is really hilarious until it's not.
Well, you know, I tell you, I sort of got a sort of a catch-22 vibe,
yeah,
undercurrent running through the film as well. Was there, and like I said, it's fictional, but are there any particular kernels or experiences you lived through or you saw as a civil affairs troop that were the foundational elements for this storyline?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the last piece of the puzzle of the screenplay for me was the actual events, right? The actual plot, right? Because
mm-hmm.
I didn't want to pick something arbitrarily. And the real life moment that sort of unlocked it all for me was this moment in Iraq, that happened to a different platoon where, there was collateral damage and, an Iraqi bakery was destroyed. And what this team had learned is that that bakery was integral to the culture of this particular town, right? It had been there for a long time. The proprietor of that establishment was a well-respected man, and we knew that if we could fix that bakery, we could make a lot of progress earning their trust, right? So everything stops, and we focus on funding and repairing alongside the Iraqis that bakery. And we succeed, and everyone's happy. And then 2 weeks later, that bakery is bombed again. And I don't know if the owner of that shop was killed. I never really found out. But I knew that that story in and of itself wasn't enough to hang a movie on. But the feeling I get when I think about that is the feeling that I wanted to impart. So I just sort of had to take that and transpose it onto something else. In this case, the idea of delivering water, you know.
Sure. Now, we've got about a minute and a half, Chris, before the next break. The main character played by Nicholas Holt is not meant to be you.
Right.
But there's another intriguing character, Captain Cyrusson, who's played by no other than Superman himself, Henry, is it Cavill? Cavill? How do you
Cavill.
Pronounce his name?
Henry Cavill, yeah.
Cavill. Was he inspired by a particular person you crossed paths with in Iraq?
You know what's funny is, listen, a lot of the Special Forces guys and Navy SEAL guys that I ran across, I kind of combined them more or less into this one character.
Mm-hmm.
But what's funny, and this will make sense given the earlier segments, is I kind of modeled them after what I imagined my dad was. I imagined what my dad was like when he was a Special Forces soldier at, 27, 28, and how I envisioned him kind of my entire life. And I just sort of put that on there. Like, it's sort of like a little Easter egg for me is that when Ochre meets Henry Cavill's character, like he's kind of meeting the idyllic soldier, the soldier that only one can imagine that they've never encountered before. So I took a lot of the characteristics from, the stories Mom told me about my dad and put it in there.
When I tell you what, the U.S. side are not the only interesting characters in the movie Sandcastle. When we come back, Chris, I want you to talk about the characters on the Iraqi side. Stick around, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
And we lit up your world.
Welcome back to American Warrior, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined on the phone by Chris Rossner. He is the screenwriter behind the film, or not behind the film, basically. It's his film, Sandcastle, debuts April 21st on Netflix. Now, Chris wrote it. I've seen it. You're going to have to wait your turn. Go to Netflix.com. If you're not already a member, you can watch it right there in the comfort of your own home. Chris, we're talking about some very intriguing characters on the U.S. side, military side, but one of the, I don't want to say sad, but no, it's not sad. One of the most inspiring characters in the movie for me was an Iraqi who started off sort of as an antagonist, or you think he's an antagonist, but by the end of the day, he's one of the bravest, most inspirational persons in the film.
That's right. It was, and that's not by accident, by the way. When I first started writing this years and years ago, it was crucial to me to represent what my experience was, and my experience was working alongside Iraqi men who were courageous enough to risk life and limb. And, when we lost interpreters, Americans were sad. And when Americans died, the Iraqis that worked with us were sad. And it was crucial to me to make sure that that message came through. And without giving too much away, and you know, it requires me to be a bit opaque, but you're absolutely right. The surprising heroism of the interpreters and, you know, some of the other Iraqi men who show up to you know, get their hands dirty and work, is pretty inspiring and unexpected, and I'm really excited to see how audiences receive that.
Now, Chris, you're from where?
I grew up in Canton, Ohio, which is where I currently am standing. It's the first time I've been in this town in about 4 or 5 years. I decided to get the hell out of Hollywood for a little bit and come home.
Probably a wise decision, but going from Ohio to Iraq, a little bit of a cultural shift.
A little bit.
On your first mission, when you're first out there interacting with people that, you know, whose military, I mean, we're shooting back and forth. What, was there a breakthrough moment or some point at which, because I think very often folks overlook, and one thing that really came out to me in this film is the fact that there was conflicts on the other side as well. And,
right.
You know, just that's where the sort of that catch-22 comes in as far as what's happening on the other side, despite what the U.S. soldiers are trying to do. Was there your first moment or a couple of moments you witnessed that in real life that brought that to bear?
I think my experience was unique in that I arrived during, you know, OIF-1, during the initial invasion, right? So when we first showed up, you know, there was some skirmishes to kind of take Baghdad and take the presidential palace in Tikrit. But that felt like it went pretty swiftly. I mean, it was harrowing, but it felt like it went pretty swiftly. And then we had this four-month period of time, more or less, where I felt like most of my job was shaking hands and, you know, quote unquote kissing babies. Like, it felt like we were being celebrated and we all felt like we were going to be out of there pretty quickly. And then when things turned, it was disheartening, but my first interaction with the Iraqi people was positive, right? And I know that if I had served in Iraq in 2006 or 7, the movie I would have written would be a bit different, but, you know, I didn't have to have a breakthrough moment because there was no facade to break through, right? Like, once the fighting was done and once we, you know, captured and set up the green zone and once we took over the presidential palace, I felt pretty welcomed, and I would venture to guess that everyone else in my unit and a lot of other soldiers did as well. So that being the case, we knew that it was possible right away. And then when the bullets started flying and the insurgents started coming at us, it was, you know, about a year and change of trying to get back to where we were when we first showed up.
Okay. Now, an interview I read with you, I really found very deep, and it pleased me. It made me smile when I read this. You said that seeing war while working civil affairs in Iraq taught you a lot about the limitless potential of the human spirit. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, with certain characters that comes through in your film on both sides, both the American sides, but particularly on the Iraqi side, that, expand on that thought a little bit more, Chris, because I thought that was so interesting. That's something our listeners could keep in mind for their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, I think what our main character goes through, what I went through, what I think a lot of young men and women who wear the uniform go through, is this realization at war that your idea of who you think you are, right, your belief about what you're capable of or not capable of, is totally irrelevant, right? It's only when we're tested do we realize if we have, you know, if we are the person we think we are, the person we say we are, right? And what's fascinating to me about war is that on one end, it upsets your idea of order. Some of the people who you thought were, you know, super stud soldiers, maybe they struggle, or maybe something goes wrong for them early on. And then maybe other folks who you thought would buckle, the exact opposite happens. But the reality is, nobody knows. And so when you spend a year and change watching, you know, young people who are, you know, 20, 21 years old, which at that time was older than what I was, but looking back on it, it seems so young.
Mm-hmm.
But you watch them do things that, even when I think about it, like, makes me cry, because I don't know how they did it. Like, I don't know how a 20-year-old kid was taking gunfire, and he sees that his buddy just lost his arm, but he's able to have the presence of mind to, like, drive him out of there or carry him out of there, right? And that's not a unique experience when you're on the ground in a war zone. And to witness that on several different occasions, it's a reminder that what an individual is capable of is totally limitless, and yet you do not know if you are capable of anything until it's challenged.
Until you're tested. You know, that's really interesting. That sort of a crucible moment is something I hear a lot about with folks that have served in combat. Chris, we've got only about 2 minutes, a little bit less than that. What do you want the viewers to take away from Sandcastle when they get up off their couch after watching it on Netflix?
Well, certainly I hope they enjoy the film, and I hope that it, you know, is entertaining, and maybe it sneaks up on them and makes them cry a little bit. But I'd say that the two most important things, and the two reasons that I cared the most about seeing this movie all the way through to the end, is, one, I am very aggressive about showing Iraqis and American soldiers working hand in hand and showing their shared sacrifice, because that's true to my experience, and I think it's important that it be represented on film. So that's number one. And number two, and just as important, I was adamant during casting that our actors look and or be young. I wanted them to look like the guys I served with. I wanted them to look like they were in their early 20s, perhaps late teens, because I think it's crucial that the American populace at large not be corrupted in their image of what an American soldier looks like or what heroicism looks like. I don't want it to be pat or cartoonish, because if we are going to send people to war, the image of who exactly we're sending to war better be abundantly clear. And chances are, I mean, you could check the statistic, but I think the average age of someone who was killed in Iraq was 20, 22. Mm. And you rarely see that represented in film. So that was super important to me. So I hope that lands with folks as well.
Well, Chris, it sure impacted me. Very well spoken. And Chris Rosner, we wish you much success. Folks, check out Sandcastle. It debuts April 21st on Netflix. You can watch it on your home computer or your TV right from the comfort of your home. And, Chris, I expect some great things from you. I think you're going to do well.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for taking the time with us, folks. Another great show. Don't forget, check us out, www.AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Like us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. Follow us on Twitter, Warrior Radio TUC. You can find these broadcasts on iTunes, podcast, Stitcher.com, Player FM. We're out there, folks. Listen to it, and please, please share these stories. Stories like Chris's need to be heard across the country. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.